April 23rd. And I think we're going to stand at ease for just a minute. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2637, and if our administrator would give us a brief overview on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2637 requires school districts to adopt a policy prohibiting cyberbullying, declares an emergency, and effective July 1st, 2007. The committee has before it a -2 amendment, which replaces the entire text of House Bill 2637 and would define cyberbullying as, quote, the use of any electronic communication device to harass, intimidate, or bully, unquote, and add cyberbullying throughout several sections of Oregon statute discussing bullying at schools and school district policies toward bullying. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe the bill's proponent is in the audience.
Thank you, Derek. And we'll hear from the proponent of the bill, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Representative Dave Hunt. This bill before you, and you also, I believe, Mr. Chair, have the amendment.
Yes, we have the -2s in front of us.
The basic focus here is placing cyberbullying into the harassment, intimidation, bullying section of the Safe Schools policy that we already, our predecessors, put in statute in 2001. Obviously, personal electronics are just proliferating in our schools. I am constantly amazed, even in my son's elementary school, how many kids have access to personal electronics. Now, I am a mean parent, so my sixth grader does not have a cell phone and will not have a cell phone anytime soon. But I mean, students now have the ability to be harassed and to harass by email, text message, picture message, as well as digital photos and videos. And I think we all have to acknowledge that this kind of harassment is just as harmful as any kind of traditional bullying, and maybe in some cases even more harmful. Videos and photos can be taken and sent with cell phone cameras, which really presents tremendous problems in locker rooms, in restrooms, as more and more students carry these personal electronics with them at school. And these problems then become even more magnified as these photos can then be published online, videos can be posted in YouTube within a matter of just minutes. So 2637 is not going to obviously eliminate that problem. House Bill 2637 is hopefully just going to increase the awareness of the harm caused by this electronic harassment, which is taking place and which I think we all have to acknowledge will be expanded in terms of taking place in our schools. House Bill 2637 will help our schools to provide safe and civil environments, which we deemed previously to be necessary for our students to learn and achieve high academic standards. The amendments before you have been crafted with input from the ACLU, although I will acknowledge they have not seen the final version of the amendment because we just got it back recently, and the bill is also has earned the support of both OSBA and COSA, although you can hear from them directly. I would be happy to entertain, Mr. Chair, any questions you or anyone else may have.
Representative Kahn.
Thanks, Chair Dahl. Representative Hunt, could you tell us, I don't know if you're, when you received the amendments, but where does it say that it requires the school district? I can't seem to pick it out. because that's what it is stating in the summary, but...
Can we talk about the S2s?
Yes.
I might be able to clarify that. Yes, our administrator, I think, can help us out here a little bit.
I believe, Chair Buckley, Representative Hunt, Representative Comp, that in Section 3, when it, on page 2, the dash 2s, it adds prohibiting cyberbullying under the list of items that a school district shall adopt a policy concerning.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, so as opposed to creating a new section, it just adds cyberbullying into the harassment, intimidation, bullying policy that's already there, where school districts already have to adopt policies on those.
Just follow-up comment.
Follow-up.
I really appreciate, Representative Hunt, that this says shall, because without a doubt, as a former middle school principal, any type of harassment, intimidation, it's just a very difficult situation, and unless we have consistency, it'd be real tough.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, and I would say several school districts, I mean, there are a few school districts in Oregon that are already ahead of us that have adopted policies already. OSBA and COSA have been encouraging school districts to do so. They obviously don't have the ability to require them to do so. We are the ones who have that ability.
Any other questions for Representative Hunt? Just one from the chair. Several school districts are out in front and doing this. Do we know of school districts that have had cyberbullying and not addressed it?
Mr. Chair, I think probably folks who are behind me can better address that question. I know there have been lots of reports of cyberbullying. I'm not sure if they occurred in school districts before, during, or after the time that they were adopting policies. But the fact that a lot of school districts still do not have cyberbullying policies, I think, is our opportunity before. And to some degree, we are really still barely at the curve. We're not ahead of the curve anymore, but we're still at the curve, I think, in terms of being able to get these policies in place before the problem just explodes. Because I think there is a real risk that this problem can explode. And I would say, as a former school board member, a lot of the times, you know, boards are constantly having to deal with policy updates and additions. And being able to say to school districts, this is one you've got to put high on your radar screen to make sure that all districts are proactively getting this in place, I think is a logical effort for us to undertake.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Roland.
Thank you. Would you see this as going across school borders? I mean, we have blogs these days, and we dealt with it when I was in school. Oregon Live is one. They do sports blogs. They do other kinds of stuff. And all of a sudden, there will be a rampant list of things picking on the play of a kid on a basketball team or a football team. And basically, really on live on these statewide blog issues, which we find it more difficult at times. Partly, you don't know who it is that did it, because the names that they use when they go on these places aren't necessarily the name of the person who's actually doing it. So tracking it down and figuring out who these people are is also very frustrating. So I guess, how are we going to handle that? Because I personally think it's a really big problem. It can be done in a big network statewide. It can be done individually from one person to another. But tracking it down is oftentimes very difficult. Now, at the school, using school equipment, I think, is one thing. That's not where it a lot of times happens. So how you go about policies, I guess, is, and as I read the bill, it's just saying you need to do something about it.
Sure.
I would like some help, personally, from a school perspective. Do you have any, have you thought of any of that stuff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roble, I think that is the challenge, because different school districts are going to face different circumstances. I think that, I mean, the requirement is, as you've stated, that they put a policy in place. Below that, the language does get more inclusive in terms of the elements that they have to include. It's not, this bill is not requiring a specific language in a specific policy, although I will tell you that OSBA has some draft policy languages, as they often do in these kinds of areas, that they're encouraging school districts to adopt. The school district has the option to you know, mend it or expand it to fit their particular circumstances. But I think you're right. The circumstance you raise, where it's not just necessarily within one school community, frankly applies not just to cyberbullying, but issues around bullying and harassment when you get into competitive environments, whether it's cyber-related or otherwise, is a very real issue.
Can I do a
follow-up?
Thank you very much. And this one has to do with freedom of speech, because that's the other problem that always comes into a case when we do this, because we are, in fact, limiting that. And so being specific and not help wanting to get school districts in legal battles that they aren't already in is another issue for me, because I think it's a really serious issue. It's how we treat each other as people in society. And I would love to do it, but I certainly don't want to get us in the place where we're avoiding this right or that right. And any ideas on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, that's exactly why the definition of cyberbullying amendment is before you, because I think the ACLU's raised very similar concerns. And so the attempt here is to focus it as clearly as possible without in infringing on legitimate free speech. It's always a difficult, I mean, anytime you're regulating language and behavior, it's always a very difficult balance to strike. Hopefully, based on the input we've got from both education groups as well as groups like the ACLU, hopefully the Dash 2 strike that balance.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do need to say, you're the majority leader. Is there any way you can get us included in this? Seriously, I mean, that's only a half unserious remark. The fact is that in the last 2 weeks, when I've been dealing with fluoridation, embryonic stem cell research, and the Senate Bill 2 and House Bill 207, I've been getting what I consider extraordinarily harassing emails. Oh. And Harriet says I don't see half of them because she deletes everything that's not from a constituent before it gets to me. But I mean, I could imagine being a 10-year-old at the kind of vulnerability that they're at, getting the kind of message that says, may the God that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah remember you on when you get there. And some of them where I just, you know, feel there's just a thinly veiled threat under some of this mail. I mean, we really do have to protect our children from that kind of stuff. And it's just so easy to fire off an email and to say something in an email that you probably wouldn't have said face-to-face. I'm really want to thank you for this. I encourage you for working on it, and especially if we get ACLU to go along with it as well.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Greenlee. And I think one of the ways that we can help foster future constituents and future legislators who have a good sense of where that balance is between legitimate free speech and completely out-of-bounds harassment, I mean, I think the best way to do that is to help proactively educate kids in school, and hopefully these policies that districts will adopt will be one step in that direction.
Representative Lim.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hunt. And according to the proposed amendment and section one subsection one, and that defines the cyberbullying, and subsection two defines harassment, intimidation, or bullying means any act that substantially interferes with a student education benefit, opportunities, or performance that takes place on or immediately adjacent to school ground, at any school-sponsored activity, on school-provided transportation, or at any official school bus stop, and that has the effect of. And what happens if someone sent to their homes? Is that not cyberbullying or what? It seems to me we are limiting on a school bus, school ground, and adjacent, and easily it could go to their house, or while they are traveling on vacation, they are sending the same message.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I think you raise a very legitimate concern. I'm just looking over the rest of the amendment and see if that Yeah. It's more inclusively covered elsewhere.
It actually isn't in location, really. It's in cyberspace. So it doesn't matter where they happen to read it.
I think we have a clarification from the committee administrator.
Clarification, Mr. Chair, is I know that I don't believe OSBA is in the audience, the Oregon School Board Association, but I believe earlier that they had mentioned that some reluctance on school policy to the extent of dealing when you get into a private home and off the school school grounds, the length of making a school district responsible for actions not taking place on school property. I think the Oregon School Board Association had some concerns along those lines. I don't want to speak for them, but my understanding is they had some concerns that about that.
Okay, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I think we are sending the wrong message. While they might wait until they go home, they do that. It's encouraging them to do that when they go home. So this seems to me a conflicting message.
Representative Cohn.
I'd offer clarification, and I had one other comment. What happens, Representative Lim, if that sort of bullying or harassment happens in the home and they report it to us at school, is the first question I always ask, did you call the police and report it? If it happens in their on their property in their homes, then those parents have the right to follow the local government issues versus the schools. And it's not always easy, but once the parents are, you know, once you give them basically permission, say, did you call the police? That's reportable. Then they go ahead and do that. So there is a line that is imaginarily drawn between when the student gets off the bus to go home on, at their location and what the school has responsibility for. But the other thing that I was going to share with Representative Hunt, I really appreciate the next section that goes into the amendments in Section 4, because I know, because it's about employees, school staff, and parents and volunteers. I know coaches that have lost their job because of comments that are on Oregon Live. And it certainly is much more far-reaching than just the students. So... It is, as Representative Roblin said, it is a huge problem.
Representative Klim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way actually I read this bill, the sections about the things that will be taking place on school grounds, that's the harassment, intimidation, or bullying, which is already in current law. The section on cyberbullying is not actually reflected in that. So it's not limited to those areas in the definition of cyberbullying. Cyberbullying just says the use of any electronic communication device to harass, intimidate, or bully. Does not specify only those places. That's for the part that's already in there on other activities. I think this is actually leaving the door open to regulate someone who, and there were stories in the Statesman Journal, I remember, all last year about MySpace and how, you know, you're attacking someone on MySpace and what's the school district's role in that. And that's sort of difficult, you know, for them to know. What is that, the parent's role? Is that the school district's role? This doesn't really... It limits them from just doing the school grounds the way I'm reading it. It actually limits them to if they want to get into a conversation about MySpace, and if you're a student here but you're doing this thing over at home, that's part of the task or the shall develop a policy part. And I think this is important. You know, I work in the computer industry and do a lot of work for residential. A lot of times what I'm doing is cleaning up the messes on people's computers that their kids have created with all the downloads of text messages. And it's clear that it is a massive way of communicating, and it's the same as any other way of communicating where sometimes kids are going to bully. And if we're going to work on it in one area, we should work on it across the medium. Representative Greenlick's got a sort of good point, I think, that clarifies... Or clarifies the problem where some communications are just sort of statement of opinion. I had one Friday that said, you will die by November for voting for Senate Bill 2. My staff called the police. The police came and took the person's phone number off my voicemail and are dealing with it. So obviously there are lines that get crossed, and that was one of them. But all the other hate mail that I got over that one was basically democracy, and you know, I'm okay with that. That particular one was not so good.
Representative Greenlee.
Well, I mean, I think we really do have to look as to whether the definition of those things is space-bound. And if it is, it's something we can take up if it's going out of here, we take up in the Senate. I mean, basically, we're talking about material that could be read in the school or could be read at home. Mm-hmm. Computers are in both places. But once it's in cyberspace, it's out there to be read virtually anywhere. And we think we need a sort of cyberspace definition of where cyberbullying could take place. It might not hurt a little. I don't think at this time of the month we're going to hang that up to clean it up now in the house.
Representative Dahlem, then Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much. I want to talk about how bullying takes place and how it is handled at the school. And when you're going to bully, and that's either physically, and we used to deal just with physically and verbally, and now we have to deal with cyber bullying, but it usually works like this. The bully makes darn sure he's not doing this where anybody can see him. And that's just good business on his part. So the school becomes involved when either the intimidated child, but most generally the intimidated child's parent, comes to the school and says, we're having to deal with this. And it is affecting the education of our child. Then the school gets involved. But I think, and I look at my colleagues up and down the board, bullying can take all sorts of forms, all sorts of venues. It is incumbent upon the school to get involved as soon as they're noticed. And I'd like that to be clear, because when you go home, sometimes we have become, it was at one time for attendance, parents in loci. And it simply says that from the step of the doorstep of the house to the classroom, that the school has a compelling interest to see to the safety of the child. I think we do that, or we try to. I don't think that we let anything interfere with that. And I think we have to understand that the school never sits by idly when one of its children is threatened, regardless of the source of the threat or the type of the threat.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to clarify the point. When usually children take, they got the message from the cyber bullying, sometimes they may not report it at all to parents or to teachers until certain point. So that's a very important point. And my point is that the subsection 2, they already is defining harassment, intimidation, and bullying, what it means is defined in here. I don't think this definition is not quite clear enough, because it limits physical location in certain areas. And so if we just take that out, subsection 2, it might just expand to anywhere. But with this defined, harassment, intimidation, or bullying means, and they defined it right there. So this is very limited defined as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Roland.
Yeah, my only concern is, I understand where you have jurisdictions in schools, but my belief is that there are very few city ordinances or state laws that allow the city to get involved with police, to get involved with very much of this bullying. It does cross a line, and you can get into some sexual harassment, you can get into some other things, and it will cross the line. But just the plain bullying, intimidation kind of bullying, schools can work with it, but if you turn that into the police, they don't do much with that. I mean, they don't really have a conversation about it, because there's not much they're going to do. And so either you need another statute there, or this needs to work in such a way that if it is coming to the school because of it is causing a problem, the schools can work with it. And having worked around this in a number of different situations to have conversations with parents and kids, and it goes between school buildings. I mean, it goes from one high school to the other high school. There's a lot of that bullying that takes place. And somehow, I agree with Representative Dahlem, when it's a problem, i.e., when it starts to disrupt the school, school people get involved with it. They may not have all the jurisdiction they need, and this may help them do that. But they try to get involved and try to solve the problem if they can. So, but I think this is something we need to do.
Thank you, Representative. I would just note, Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, if I mean, obviously the geographic limiting language that we're talking about is in Section 1, Subsection 2, which is already in the current statute. This now adds on, this bill would add cyberbullying into that. But as I
As I read it, I think it is talking about the same harassment, intimidate, and bully that is referenced in subsection 2 there.
I agree.
Our predecessors may have had some great rationale for why they geographically limited. It's possible they may have not. And, I mean, if it's the committee's will to pass the bill out now, I would be happy to work with OSBA and COSA and others to see if there is a way to get at those issues off grounds that Representative Lim and others have raised without, you know, being some undue burden on school districts, giving them something that is much larger than they have the ability to control.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much for bringing the proposal forward. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
What do you have to add? We're inside.
We have Nancy Willard.
Thanks. Hold up the reading material for you guys.
Thank you so much.
This one you just get to look at. This is my book on cyberbullying, and this is my book on cyber-safe kids and cyber-savvy teens. So,
okay.
You get to pass that around while I'm talking.
Very good. Will you please introduce yourself when you get settled there?
And yes. Thank you. My name's Nancy Willard, and I'm from Eugene, Oregon. I'm director of a program called the Center for Safe and Responsible Internet Use. I have a master's degree from University of Oregon in special ed, working with emotionally disturbed at-risk kids, doctor of jurisprudence from Willamette University, practiced technology law, got much more interested in what technology was doing in schools, helped in the original development of the Oregon Public Education Network, helped 40% of Oregon schools develop their first technology plan. Mm-hmm. Since 1995, I've been focusing on youth risk online and student internet use at school. In the last 3 years, I saw cyberbullying coming before MySpace. I've been working on the issue of cyberbullying, and I've endeavored to take a full research-based approach to dealing with this, and I happen to have a foot in the legal arena, a foot in the youth risk arena, as well as educational planning and implementation. I've actually become, if you type cyberbully in Google, my site will be the first one that comes up. I was asked by the U.S. Department of Education, Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools, to present to their annual conference. I was requested by the National School Board Association to make presentations. I presented to the Council for Urban School Districts as well as the Leadership Council in January. I'm working with the Center for Disease Control on a publication on cyberbullying, and I'm writing the article on legal issues. And I just flew back to meet with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Division of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. They're the folks who have the Safe Schools, Healthy Students grants. So I'm here to help you solve the problem that Representative Lim so appropriately addressed. Cyberbullying is an increasing problem. And from all of the research that we've been able to see, It's potentially even more harmful for kids. Kids communicate, you know, Representative Greenlich, from the emails you've received. There's this, I call it the you can't see me, I can't see you factor that leads to this harm. We are seeing increased reports of harm, student emotional distress, school failure, school avoidance, school violence, youth suicide, all associated with cyberbullying. Now, the reason, by the way, you have these documents is that I hadn't had the chance to see the proposed amendments, and so I'm going to send you the testimony and tell you how you can fix this bill afterwards. This is a document published by the National School Board Association on the legal issues, and you'll see that on the back page they referenced my material. Wrong URL, but they referenced my material. This is a document for educators. It's an educator's guide to dealing with issues of cyberbullying, and includes brief information in here, far more extensive in my book, about the legal issues. This is a handout that I have on my website that schools can download and provide to parents to provide information to them on how to deal with these issues. Now, if you enact this law with the current language, you will be shooting Oregon school districts in the foot because you will be specifically restricting their ability to respond to cyberbullying. And Representative Lynn gets the award for pointing out where and how. Cyberbullying, Representative Clem, because Section 1 says harass, intimidate, and bully, and Section 2 is harass, intimidation, and bullying, cyberbullying is a vehicle by which harassment, intimidation, and bullying are occurring. So those two are linked. The language takes place immediate adjacent to school grounds, school activity, etc., was quite appropriate in the era where bullying was only taking place in the real world. We've got bullying taking place in cyberspace, but because it's involving students, the impact is being felt at school. And that's where you've got the problem, because you've got kids who are bullied off campus who are now unwilling to come to school. You have bullying incidents that are occurring outside that are raising the potential of violence at school. Now, in the courts that have assessed this, the standard they have enunciated for school districts to respond to off-campus speech is called the Tinker Standard. Now, I got concerns with free speech with the ACLU. I can show you where the ACLU recently, in the free speech case that was argued before the Supreme Court, Morris v. Fredericks, fully encouraged the Supreme Court to adopt the Tinker Standard. The Tinker Standard allows school officials to impose formal discipline if the off-campus speech has caused or threatens to cause substantial disruption at school or interference with the student's rights to be secure. Now, I'm going to give you a little test here. This is what I do in my presentations with school administrators. This is a Representative Comp, you were middle school principal?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. This one occurred. Peter Tromba was principal of North Eugene High School. He had three students who had gotten involved in an altercation, two Caucasian, one African American. He thought he resolved it. Shortly thereafter, the Caucasian students set up a website that was highly racist. Pictures, cartoons of lynching, a news story of dragging African Americans behind a car and killing them, really bad. And other students from the school started signing on to this. The black African American student found out, told the Black Students Association. Fortunately, told Peter. Now, I ask you, have we passed this threshold of threat of substantial disruption at school? Okay, that's pretty clear. This next story took place in Drain. Lisa Haley, principal. Students, high school girls, created a We Hate Ashley profile. Ashley was a student in the school. This profile had all sorts of really negative stuff about Ashley. Ashley was doing okay. Yeah, but the child in the Midwest who stabbed another boy in the back in the library with a knife was also doing okay, as was the child, you know. So have we passed? It was foggier in that case, probably. Lisa didn't feel that she had passed that threshold. That's where the difficulties come for administrators. If you leave the statute in the manner that's currently written, next year, if Peter Tromba or any other principal who tries to face a situation like that imposes formal discipline on those students, it's very likely he'll get hauled into court. Why? Because at this point in time, you have now limited his authority to respond to any off-campus bullying, cyberbullying, because you've said he can only respond to cyberbullying if it occurs immediately adjacent to school grounds, at a school-sponsored activity, school-provided transportation, official bus stop. And there are free speech proponents who want that to be the limit. Now, the ACLU argued a different limit, in court, but there are free speech proponents who do not want school officials to respond. Well, the problem is, as the ACLU argued in the Morris B. Fredericks case, you've got to balance student free speech rights with the safety and security interests of schools. Now, I didn't bring a lot of copies of this. I can send it electronically. I can leave a number of copies. What the state of Arkansas did was not only did they incorporate language, and I've already sent some memos to you folks. I'm not sure they've been read. I've already sent some memos to you folks where I basically recommend that you expand this language to in Section 2 to include a number of different areas. First of all, use of the district internet system on or off campus, use of a personal digital device, cell phone, laptop, PDA, on campus, and then you have to add off-campus activity and then just simply put the Tinker standard in there that has caused or threatens to cause substantial disruption at school or interference with the rights of students to be secure. Okay? You do that, your statute's fine. If you don't do that, you are shooting Oregon school administrators in the foot and not allowing them to respond to these issues. Now, what they did in Arkansas is they actually went further and provided some statutory language about what substantial disruption means. And so it helps clarify to the school administrator, okay, if I can demonstrate we meet this standard, and then we're going to be able to deal with it. Now, school administrators, a lot of them don't really understand this area, and they're fearful of new responsibilities. How far, you know, the question is how far does my authority go, but it's also how far does my responsibility go? They don't actually have the authority to impose formal discipline outside of the Tinker standard. You can't expand outside of that. That's a constitutional standard. They don't have the authority to impose. You will see in the NSBA document, and it's also in my document, that if they can't impose formal discipline, they can still work informally to resolve these issues. And I advise that school officials do, because quite frankly, if you can stop the problem at a level when it hasn't reached a substantial disruption, then that's better. A lot of that then requires focusing on education of students and education of parents and education of school administrators about the alternative methods that they can use to get these situations resolved. And I've actually provided some really helpful information in this parent document for school administrators to be able to hand. There's a larger parent document also on my website. But it says under the section, prevent your child from being a cyber bully. If you know your child has cyberbullied others, be very proactive in preventing any continuation. You can be held financially liable for the harm your child causes to another. So basically, if the parent knows, that enhances the ability, that essentially allows a civil lawsuit under parental negligence. The comprehensive approach that I've tried to lay out really does, it's grounded in education, but you've got to preserve, you've got to amend this language. You cannot let this bill pass in its current form. You will prevent school officials from responding when they really have to. It is really relatively simple to amend this section and remedy that and achieve what you want to achieve. Questions?
Thank you. Questions, members? No questions?
Procedural for the chair.
Representative Dolan.
It appears to me, and my note says, that we need this legislation to empower schools, but we also need work. Can we get that work done in time?
That is my concern. Representative Hunt did mention when he was here that he'd be willing to work on the Senate side to get this done, and I might, given our schedule, I might concern on time if we try to do it within the next 7 days. we might lose this.
I am quite willing to help and facilitate that. I have been communicating with Representative Hunt, and I happen to know the chair of the Senate Education Committee personally, since we're both from Eugene.
Very good.
Actually, I'm a former Eugene Celebration Slug Queen, but I didn't tell you that.
Just a quick question.
Slug Queen.
Slug Queen. Okay.
The folks from Eugene, they're shaking their head, going, "Yeah, we know."
Well, I believe that is the course of action that we will take with this bill, then.
Okay, and I'm quite willing to help Representative Hunt with recommended language to improve this and work with the Senate committee to get that passed. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
Your comments were great.
Thank you for your work.
And how do you like that? Well, behaved son.
Thank you for your son. Are we just in a public hearing now? Or?
Yes.
Okay, so then I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2637. I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 2637. We have a dash 2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding the dash 2s are acceptable to ACLU. Has that been worked out?
I have not had... Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleaf, my understanding from Representative Hunt's office is that they were involved in the drafting of the Dash 2. I'm not sure if they saw the final version as back from LC, but they were involved in previous. I don't think we're able to be here today.
So. Well, yeah, actually, Ellen Lowe was here representing ACLU. Told me at the beginning of the hearing.
Okay, we have no one further on the sign-up sheet. If there's
I think
there's a dollar.
Mr. Chairman, I recommend a procedure because I would really like to see this bill before it goes out of here. I think our school districts need this authority. And if you would schedule on the last day possible, I would pass it without the amendment, but I would really like to see the amendment in this committee.
The proposed amendment.
We have a conceptual amendment now that lacks a little bit of meat on the bones, but I would like to see it.
I appreciate it. My only concern is I do not know if we have a consensus from the parties, and if ACLU is who isn't here.
I think that's what she was telling me. They had looked it up, but you're right. She had not seen the final dash two.
So my concern is if we do delay this. I mean, we could delay this, and then if they can't come to an agreement or amendment, just send it over as is and let them keep working on the other side. Or
I'd like to hold on to it as long as I can.
I know Mr. Olson's getting older by the minute as we talk about adding bills to the schedule here. Representative Lim.
In my opinion, because time is the essence, I think it's prudent enough. If you got time, you can work on this one amendment, but let's send it to the Senate, let them work on it, and if it's a good one, we can concur. If not, we don't have to concur, and maybe at some conference committee, we might be able to adjust it, but that's my personal opinion.
I appreciate your guidance, Representative Dahl.
But the trouble is, if we send it over there half-baked, and it comes out of there half-baked, then it's half-baked law. Whereas if we treat it here, and it's changed, then we have another shot at it. But we let go of it, and it's not fixed. We have no recourse. We never see it again.
Further comments? Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. My only comment is that I'm very confident that Representative Hunt's a man of his word, so if he says he'll follow through with it, I'm okay with it.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion?
I would say let's adopt the dash 2. So.
Representative Greenick is that a motion, Representative?
Motion.
Representative Greenick moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2637. Further discussion? Hearing none. Objection?
Question. If we're going to send an abomination across the hall, why would we send it with an amendment that we know handcuffs the district? I mean, let's send it. I mean, if they're going to do work, they can do all the work.
Well, there's been a lot of work done on the dash twos now, and there's only one clause that we're worried about amending. with that. I think most of the work in the guys too is again work between the two parties, and at least that's my understanding.
Well, my only comment is, in all due respect for the witness, we've heard one other interpretation.
Oh, I think the witness is right on this one.
Well, I don't disagree with her, but.
But I think it's really easy to correct. I don't see the problem.
Members, in deference to Representative Hunt, I'm going to go ahead and call the roll, and we'll go ahead and vote on the amendment, and. Representative Dahl, I will try to run her on this as well to take your concerns into consideration, and
put it on the floor too.
We will be able to make sure we get the act that we want to get out of this. So if the clerk would please call the roll.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Dahl?
So feel free to vote anyway.
No.
Representative Greenlight?
It's on the amendment.
It's on the amendment.
It's on the amendment.
Yes.
Representative Hall?
Aye.
Representative
Crumwell? Excuse?
Representative
Lim?
Aye.
Representative
Roblin?
Excuse.
Representative
Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Buckley? Aye.
So amended?
I move the House Bill, I lost the number, 2637, as amended with a dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Greenlick has moved House Bill 2637. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Dahl?
Aye.
Representative Greenlight?
Aye.
Representative
Hummel?
Excused.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Excused.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye, with the assurance by the chair that it's going to be corrected based upon the excellent testimony we heard from this lady.
Yeah. One heck of a vote, Representative.
Aye.
It's better than the Curtis and no one.
The motion carries. It certainly is. Is there a volunteer for carrier for this on the floor? Should we offer it to Representative Hunt?
Yes.
Offer Representative Hunt. That's what I was doing. We'll offer that to Representative Hunt. Thank you, Mr. Olson. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2637, and I'd like to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3267. And Representative Greenlick is going to make his way down.
And not
courtesy, no.
That's all right.
As,
it was threatened, but not used.
Mr. Olson, if you would be so kind.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3267 creates a task force on the coordination of behavioral science research, declares an emergency, is effective on passage, and it sunsets at the opening of the next regular biennial legislative session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. So I believe we have Representative Greenlick is joining us in front, and along with Anthony Biglin, I believe. And it's your show, Representative. You can take it away.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I'm Mitch Greenlick, State Representative, House District 33, Northwest Portland and West. Parties West, and I really appreciate you doing a hearing on House Bill 3267, and I hope a work session to follow. We have some extraordinary social scientists in the state of Oregon, running, I'm sure, all the way from the Columbia River south to the Siskiyou and east and west as well. The crew you'll be hearing from, a crew at University of Oregon today, that have been very much involved in social science research. Dr. Biglin and I have worked together for many years, and through all those years, before I was in state government, we talked about how you could bring these extraordinary resources to bear on dealing with problems in the state and in other local governments and in nonprofit organizations doing God's work helping helping us create a better state and a better society. But sometimes it's very hard to mobilize those resources. For example, we had a bill you may be familiar with, Mr. Chair, talking about autism and how it ought to be treated. And when I started, of course, the first thing I did was call Dr. Bigland to get some help, and started trying to find resources, and it was a matter of looking here, looking there. Gee, so-and-so's, I've got a paper on that, let's call him, kind of thing. It became even clearer to me, even though this bill had already been written at that time, even clearer to me how sometimes it was very hard to bring the quite extraordinary resources we have in this state to bear to help us with problems. The other side, and I don't think you'll hear the scientists testifying on this, but the other side of it is that it's also very important to teach the social scientists who want to help us how to help. I have a whole talk on how scientists and clinicians can help affect public policy. And one of the points that I make in this is that we as scientists, and I'm a social scientist as well, and I've been working on public policy for a long time, are experts, and we really know a lot about a field. But when it comes to public policy, we're novices, and I learned that my first year here. I love the idea that I went from a position in my career, in my life, where I was usually the person in the room who knew the most about any topic, to being a rookie. And it was a really good feeling. And it's really interesting to help scientists as they come, and I try and tutor them as they come to talk to us about how to deal with us. Social scientists spend most of the time talking to other social scientists, and that's how many references per minute can you name, and how articulate can you be, and how much social science jargon can you use in each situation. So it's a two-way street. It's a how we get social scientists to help us when we need evidence-based information on fields, and how do we help the social sciences learn how to help us in a way that we can have a much more effective relationship. This bill talks about creating a task force that would bring some of the great social scientists together in this state. And we have social scientists that have won awards in so many different fields we can hardly count them. How to bring some of them together to deal with the question of how do we maximize the ability of the social scientists in the area to help us create public policy and to do our work better. And this would be a task force, you see in the bill, that would do two things, that would create an inventory of social science research that can be easily applied. We just heard an example in the bill, in the bill just before this. How do you get a database of usable social science research, and also how to get a database of usable social scientists, so that it would be easy if we're dealing with a bill on mental health problems in the high school. We've got folks that have been working on that for years and years and years, and we ought to be able to just go pluck them out of a database and say, hey, come and talk to us about this one. So basically, we're trying to create a resource. It's a short-term shot at it. This isn't something that will go on forever and ever. It sunsets, as our administrator said. But it really could set up something that would be very helpful to us. And with that, I'll wait for questions. I'll sit here and hold Dr. Bigland's hand. I know how shy he is. And
okay. Thank you, Rick.
I can feel better.
Thank you, Representative Greenleg. Doctor, please go ahead and identify yourself.
My name is Anthony Bigland. I'm a senior scientist at Oregon Research Institute, and I'm also president of the Society for Prevention Research, which is the International Organization of Prevention Scientists. I was recently appointed to a National Academy of Sciences committee to review what the nation knows about prevention so that it could be used more effectively. This is a process that Representative Greenlick knows about since he chaired a National Academy of Sciences committee on the treatment of drug abuse. I handed out a statement that lists just example after example of world-class research done in Oregon being used around the world, but in fact not being used as much as it might be here in Oregon. I just want to highlight two of those. One is Marion Forgach is a scientist at Oregon Social Learning Center. Oregon Social Learning Center is the place that's developed parenting interventions for children with aggressive behavior problems. There are very few people in our Oregon prisons that didn't have aggressive behavior problems as children. Well, they've developed this program over the last 40 years and shown through numerous trials, randomized control trials, that this is an effective intervention. The entire country of Norway now has implemented Oregon Social Learning Center's behavioral parenting skills training program. They've even done a study where they showed that implementing it had a significant impact on the aggressive behavior problems of children in Norway. So the entire country has now adopted this, thanks to their having brought Marion Forgach over there to work with them. Now Holland is doing it, and also the state of Michigan. So it's just one example of the kind of resources we have here, and I keep saying to Marion, when are you going to come to Oregon and do this kind of thing? Another example, also from Oregon Social Learning Center, is a program using essentially the same principles, but working with adolescents who've been adjudicated and putting them into foster family care, where the foster families are very well trained and get backup 24/7 from people at Oregon Social Learning Center. And that program has been found to be one of the most effective. This third page of my handout shows the an analysis that the Washington State Institute for Public Policy did on this program that basically showed that the program not only reduces recidivism of juvenile offenders, but that the cost savings in terms of reducing crime costs and juvenile justice costs is about $77,000 per person receiving this program. So it's just an example of the kind of thing that good behavioral science research can do. And here again, this program has been nationally recognized as being implemented and disseminated around the country, and Oregon is using it to some extent. But again, I think if behavioral scientists were more interacting with policymakers and practitioners about these things, it could be a benefit to the state of Oregon. The other thing I mentioned in there is that behavioral science research is actually an industry cluster, if you're familiar with that term. There's about $100 million in monies coming into Oregon for behavioral science research. And I think that this is a key moment for the behavioral sciences, because we've gotten to the point where we know an awful lot about what can be done to prevent and treat the problems of human behavior that we confront. But now the question is, how do we effectively get that out there? Well, that's a question for more research from our perspective. And that research
Every question is a question for more research.
That's true. The T-shirts at ORI used to have a slogan, more research is needed. You know, so we only hoped we'd do it. But the point is that because the behavioral sciences are at a point of saying, well, how can we get this out there? The place to do it is by working with practitioners and service providers and policymakers to do that. I'm currently doing two randomized trials, one on alcohol access reduction and the other on tobacco reduction, that we're doing in cooperation with state agencies. And so that kind of collaboration is possible and is growing. So I guess the last thing I'd say is, two things. One is Tom DeShawn couldn't be here. He's at the Child and Family Center at the University of Oregon. He's sent you a statement which I delivered. And I guess the other thing is that we're eager to try to be helpful to the state of Oregon. So if you voted to do this, I think we would be diligent and would be of value to the state. Shall I introduce?
You did great. Is there any questions?
Committee, any questions for this panel?
Yeah.
Representative Lynn.
And I didn't get your name quite.
My name is Anthony Biglin.
Thank you, Anthony. Appreciate it. You mentioned $100 million coming to this state for behavioral science. Can you expand a little bit more about it? It's quite a bit of money.
There are actually quite a number of research organizations in the state. There's the Center for Health Research, which was founded and led for many years by Representative Greenlick.
That at the moment has about $35 million a year in federal research that comes into Oregon.
Oregon Research Institute, where I work, is about $20 million a year, and mostly in federal funds from the National Institutes of Health. Oregon Social Learning Center, which will be represented by Mark Eddy, that Oregon Social Learning Center is our crosstown rival in Eugene, and they have a similar size budget, about $20 million. The University of Oregon has a substantial budget in behavioral sciences, especially in the College of Education and in the psychology department, and the Oregon State University and Oregon Health Sciences University. It's easily $100 million.
Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Any other questions, committee? Well, thank you. It sounds like it's a great beginning.
Thank you.
If we could have a second panel with Jeffrey Fellows, Brian Flay, and Mark Eddy. And Jeffrey, you were the first one to sign up, so we'll have you start whenever you're ready.
He's a little off. It's more.
Oh, good.
For the record, my name is Jeffrey Fellows. I'm a health economist and investigator from Kaiser Permanente Center for Health Research. What Representative Greenlick didn't say was that prior to his becoming a rookie in the Oregon legislature, what he did is spent time building our research center since its founding in 1964. I'm not coming here to talk about the multitude of research and good work that we've done for the citizens of Oregon and the country and the world, particularly under Representative Greenlick's tutelage, but because that's all out there and we would be here until next week. The Center for Health Research has more than 46 years experience in research and with a focus on epidemiology, clinical trials, disease prevention, and health promotion. We currently have about 225 staff, although that's always a moving target. Our revenues have been increasing over the last 3 years. Even during the tightening of the belt at NIH, we've become much more active in doing our research, and we've expanded our research portfolio. We have over 30 medical doctors and PhD level researchers, 11 affiliate investigators, and 9 clinical investigators from other institutions. We have a center in Hawaii, a location in Hawaii, and we just expanded to a southeast region in Atlanta, Georgia. So we do research across the country from each of those sites. My primary work and has been on estimating the health and economic consequences of tobacco use, implementing and evaluating tobacco cessation interventions in large populations, and leading a practice leading a practice-based research program within dental clinics. And I do want to say that this testimony here doesn't necessarily represent the views of Kaiser Permanente. But I am honored to be able to present to you today some testimony. I really have 3 main points. First of all, we do support this bill. I think one of the things, as I see it anyway, is that this is one method that will help promote access to evidence-based clinical practice. Center for Health Research and researchers there have had a long history of conducting research that has become the foundation for many of the evidence-based practice guidelines, the clinical and community level practice guidelines that are written and published by the U.S. Public Health Service. And in fact, one of our recent studies of the Oregon quitline, tobacco quitline, represented 46% of the weight of a recent Cochrane collaboration evaluation in the effectiveness of Oregon of quitline services. So in that way, this bill represents to the point that to the extent that it will promote evidence-based practice and access to that and promotion of that, this is a good bill. Secondly, this bill corresponds very well with NIH's goal of reducing the time between an initial scientific discovery and its wide implementation in daily practice. Currently, it's about 16 years between there's an initial scientific discovery and its adoption in daily practice. That's a tremendously long period of time, and there's a lot of lives that are lost and a lot of healthcare dollars that are wasted during that period of time. NIH has embarked on a very extensive policy and process to shorten that gap, and part of that is the expansion of and promotion and funding of practice-based research networks. There are several that are medical providers dealing with medical practice. There's an Oregon Rural Practice-Based Research Network that is established here with NIH funds. I'm the local principal investigator of a dental practice-based research network. And we're one of three PBRN, dental PBRNs across the country, and we work with the Kaiser Dental Associates, and we also work with health partners in Minnesota and dentists in the Southeast region and in Scandinavia as part of our PBRN. In fact, Representative Greenlick, it's probably the reason I'm sitting here today and talking about the Dental Practice-Based Research Network is because in the early 70s, Representative Greenlick began the Kaiser Dental Practice prepaid dental plan as a research project. And it's now grown to include, to cover about 180,000 Oregonians and Southwest Washingtonians. And we have over 120 dentists. And we are on the forefront of providing evidence-based dental practice in the state of Oregon, and in indeed the country. We're an example of that is we're currently through our dental practices and plans and through this PBRN research, we're looking at the risks and prevalence of osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is a recent topic that has come up that's a concern with bone death that results from taking bone density building drugs in a small number of cases of folks. Part of the funding that we have was not mentioned is that Kaiser Center for Health Research, along with Oregon Health Sciences University, recently was awarded a $55 million five-year grant to develop it's a Clinical Translation Sciences Award, and we've established the Oregon Clinical Translation Research Institute, and that is going to support research that is bench to bedside focus, and the goal of that is to dramatically reduce that time between scientific discovery and its wide adoption in clinical care. And it's a multidisciplinary translational research teams, and we're very, very excited about that. Currently, and last year, we submitted as a center, our investigators submitted over $95 million worth of grant proposals, and that is a target that we're consistently trying to meet every year. The third point that I wanted to make, and I think it's been talked about, and Representative Greenlick described himself and others as social scientists. I'm a social scientist myself, but the title in this bill says behavioral research scientists, and in my former life at CDC as a health economist, I actually applied for a research staff position as a behavioral research scientist, and the Human Relations Department told me I was not a behavioral scientist and to go elsewhere. And so I had to wait for another announcement that was more broadly stated. And so I think that what I would like to see in this bill is to have the title to be more inclusive, to include biological, clinical, and social scientists. That would certainly, I think, probably increase the risk of not coming to any conclusion from a task force because of the breadth and the scope of participation. But I think that as far as the maintaining and positioning yourselves ourselves on the leading edge of where science is going, and that is the translation, multidisciplinary translational teams, I think that would help establish this commission in that area. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, I thank you for the opportunity to present here today, too. My name is Brian Flay. I'm professor of public health at OSU and director of the Prevention Research Center there. I've just recently moved here from Chicago, where I was the founding director of a prevention research center that is of similar size to the center that we've just been talking about. I'm a social psychologist by training, but have worked in public health and health behavior for my whole career, 30-odd years, starting in looking at preventing kids from smoking, using drugs, and then getting engaged in violence, and then engaging in unsafe sexual behaviors and AIDS prevention, so expanding across the years. And I now talk more about health promotion and positive youth development. And these are all related and inform each other. I'm also a member of the Society for Prevention Research, of which Dr. Biglin is currently the president. And I recently chaired a committee for that society on establishing standards for evidence-based practices. So that society under my leadership has an established set of standards for evidence-based practice in prevention and promotion. I've also served on several Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Science committees related to prevention of AIDS, control of tobacco use, and so forth. In the sheet that I handed out, I have a list of investigators from Oregon State University who are engaged in the social and behavioral sciences. I'll adopt broader terminology. And who are doing interesting and important work that will inform not only Oregonians but people nationally and internationally about the best ways of preventing obesity, increasing physical activity, improving the health of disadvantaged populations, including the homeless, and so forth, and improving the health of the elderly. The Department of Public Health at Oregon State University, about half of the faculty are behavioral scientists and two-thirds are social scientists. And we have the only PhD program in public health in the state, and we participate with PSU and OHSU in the Oregon Masters of Public Health that I believe that Representative Greenlick had a large role in setting up. That program has been ranked second among graduate programs in community health recently by U.S. News and World Report. From the work at OSU, I'll just point out some of the work that I'm involved in with Carol Allred, the developer of the Positive Action Program. She has offices in Idaho and in Corvallis. And this program was recently the only one to achieve the highest ratings in the U.S. Department of Education's What Works Clearinghouse review of character education programs, and the highest rating both in improving student behavior and improving student academic scores. And we're doing studies on that program in different parts of the country. It's being used in over 12,000 schools around the country, but very few in Oregon so far. obviously I support and my colleagues from OSU support the creation of this task force, and I think that it would help ensure that the population of Oregon benefits from the advances being made by social scientists in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Mark Eddy. I'm a research scientist and licensed psychologist at the Oregon Social Learning Center, and I'm pleased to be here today. Thank you, Chair Buckley and representatives. The state of Oregon has a very unique situation given our size in terms of the abundance of research scientists with national and international level expertise in the area of preventing the development of mental disorders and related problems, as well as in clinically intervening with these disorders and the problems once they've begun. Research conducted at the nonprofit Oregon Social Learning Center, where I work, over the past 30 years has demonstrated that a vital part of the solution to many of the disorders and problems of childhood is the strengthening of parents and parent figures. Someone has to be a loving, strong parent to each of our children in Oregon. Someone has to supervise, encourage, discipline our children, and effectively help each child figure out how to solve his or her problems. Our work at OSLC has focused specifically on working with families who are in particularly stressful situations in which parenting has been or can be very difficult, such as families involved with the child welfare system, families involved with the juvenile justice system, or families involved with the criminal justice system. At OSLC, we have developed a variety of evidence-based programs designed to help parents help their children, and in a recent review of 12 national-level best practices lists relevant to children and families, 81% of the programs on three or more of these lists have been directly influenced by work at OSLC. While we've been busy developing and testing interventions for children and families and disseminating our findings within the research community, our resources are very limited in terms of being able to disseminate those findings to the practice and policymaker communities. And I believe, as Jeff noted, that on average it takes 16 years for findings to go from research to practice. In recent years, we have developed a close partnership with the Oregon Department of Corrections, originally under Dave Cook's leadership, then Ben DeHaan, and more recently Max Williams, during which time we jointly created and are now testing an evidence-informed parenting program for incarcerated parents called Parenting Inside Out. This type of partnership, I think, is one of the things that could be encouraged by the bill that's on the table. The proposed bill, in my opinion, is a worthy attempt to try to better connect policymakers and practitioners in the state with researchers in the hopes of enriching the standard of practice around the state in terms of prevention and intervention programs, and in terms and in turn improving the lives of the children and families of Oregon.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Clem.
Thank you. Let's figure out here. Dr. Fellows,
yeah.
Welcome, other doctor. My question, I noticed you do a lot of tobacco-related research, and I just wondered if you knew, because we're debating some other bills around here, and I always hear studies, do you have a sense of what the, quote, subsidy would be from society to a tobacco, a pack of cigarettes per pack? Have you ever...
Off the top of my head... No, smoking is a trip. There are between 6.5% and 8.5% of annual medical care expenditures can be attributed to tobacco use, perhaps as much as 5% for smokers may lose 5% of their productivity on an annual basis because of excess absenteeism and additional smoke breaks. There is some research. There's some research emerging that suggests that smokers, even while they're at their desk, are a little less productive because of the nature of addiction. And so, if you look at a $30,000 a year earning $30,000 a year, 5% of that is $1,500 in lost productivity. The calculation of the medical costs of smoking on an annual basis is going to be somewhere over $1 billion in Oregon. $80 to $89 billion nationally And one of the things that I've done in my work, you know, when I did some testimony across while I was at CDC, I would go to state and testimony and give testimony about the health and economic consequences of tobacco use. And typically it was debating a bill about funding the tobacco control program that the state had. One thing I found regularly was, okay, well, we know it's a big problem. What can you do for us, and how can you demonstrate that what you're going to do is going to reduce this problem? We were able to fund research from CDC, and I led the research that did that with some outside research organizations that demonstrated the effectiveness of those comprehensive programs at reducing, and that was independent of the taxes that typically went into play to fund those programs.
Absolutely.
And then here at Center for Health Research, one of the first things I did with some Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funding was to use Kaiser member data over several years to track what happened to smokers and quitters, and how their disease incidence, their quit decisions based upon their health status at the time, and their enrollment status, and then I used that information to ask questions around whether quitters are more expensive than current smokers, and whether they're going to quitters are going to leave the health plan, because health plans were concerned about that. And then I used that to make some assumptions and model what the return on investment would be to a health plan from interventions, system level interventions to reduce smoking, and found that there was a positive return on investment to health systems efforts that would be between $1 and $2 per member per month after 5 years. And so it's about $6,000 per quitter in medical expenditure savings
over 5 years.
And that's net of the cost of getting them to quit. And we did that comparison to a usual care, doing little intervention.
Thank you, Representative. Members, so just to give a kind of focus on the time, we have one more bill to focus on as well. So questions can be kept succinct if possible.
Fairly quick one. First, I want to say thank you for reassuring me of my admiration for Representative Greenlick by your testimony at the beginning, because I've always known that from when I got here, but I couldn't believe all the things I've heard, and now each group comes up with something different that he was instrumental in, and so now I actually believe all the things I've heard are probably all true, which is also nice. But on that said, subject,
cost me a lot of money.
But on that subject, with regard to, and this is from my own knowledge about another issue that's coming up, and that is you do research on things that can help, like the smoking cessation. Have you done any on fluoride and its whether it's a positive thing for?
Not personally. Others have, and there's a dentist in the Kaiser system who promoted that. I've seen the literature. What I've seen so far is that water fluoridation makes sense. It's a public health preventive measure, with slight risks for over exposure, but that risk is very slight, and would probably be ameliorated by dentists knowing that kids were getting fluoride in the water.
Thank you.
Okay, want to say that cougars too at all?
Yeah.
Chairman, thank you so much. We have one other witness here from on this bill. Appreciate your time.
You can discuss it again.
Thank you so much. Gina Nickel.
Oh, thank
you. They're all back.
Hey, Jeff.
Chair Buckley, committee members, for the record, my name is Dr. Gina Nickel. I'm the executive director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and I also teach at OHSU in the Department of Psychiatry. I'm here to say that this committee will greatly enhance the work of our state-county partnerships that we do in informing the shared services that we provide in the behavioral health system. When Senate Bill 267 was passed a couple sessions ago, It required 25%, 50%, and then 75% moving to evidence-based practices. Only it forgot one piece of the bill, and this bill provides that. I'm very excited about our research scientists in the behavioral health field getting together to informing our system. Please pass the bill. And thank you for Representative Greenlick for doing this work.
Thank you, Dr. Nickel. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kremel.
I do have a question of my constituent, Dr. Nickel. Notice how I slid that in there.
Yeah, that's very nice.
In the bill, it on page one, it refers to one representative from the Department of Human Services who provides addiction and mental health services. And I'm curious, from your perspective, shouldn't that really be two different people? I mean, shouldn't there be one person that is dealing with addiction services and one person that deals with mental health, as opposed to having one person that's trying to cover both areas?
Okay. Chair Buckley, Representative Kremel, that department has been combined. So technically, it's the Department of Addictions and Mental Health. It's a good catch. I know the field would feel better if there was one from mental health and one from addictions, but technically we're trying to blend the field. So I think as written, it probably would pass the straight face test.
She says with a smirk on her face. Follow-up, Mr.
Quick follow-up. Follow
quick, just a quick follow-up, and that is, I realize that the department has been blended, and I realize that there's, but it seems to me, and especially since we're wanting to move towards evidence-based medicine in healthcare in general, it seems to me that because they really are, and I recognize that there is that the two are connected. I mean, people that have mental health issues a lot of times have addiction issues, and vice versa. But they're still two separate fields. And I'm just wondering if it wouldn't be behooves to have a person that really works in the area of addiction and a person that really works in the area of mental health. Or am I just kind of all wet here?
Chair Buckley, Representative Cromwell, we would be glad to have two representatives.
Thank you very much.
You'll also find lots of folks in the rest of the group who work in both mental health and in substance abuse. Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes, Representative.
Are you authorized to speak for anybody else in your house?
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlick, I think I take the fifth on that.
There is a letter, for the record, and we all did receive a letter.
Yeah, I was trying to make sense out of what may or may not be a fiscal on it. So.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nick. For the record, she whispered, there's no fiscal. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3267. And, Representative Greenlick, I am inclined to open a work session for you if you care for one at this time, and or if there's any other.
Chair, I would very much like a work session at this time.
I'm going to open a work session of House Bill 3267.
And to kick off that work session, I move House Bill 3267 to the House floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Representative Dahlin moves House Bill 3267 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kremel.
Shouldn't this be going to Ways and Means? Isn't there a fiscal on this?
There is not currently a fiscal, and the letter from Mr. Nichols infers that there will be a fiscal, but it's my impression it will be less than the proverbial $50,000 limit. But if it goes to Ways and Means, you know it's going to be lost in a morass. I wonder whether we could get any more information on the likelihood of a significant fiscal.
Mr. Olson, your thoughts?
Chair, Representative Greenlick, Representative Cromwell, I did speak to the Department of Human Services legislative liaison today. They're working on a fiscal. There is not, as far as response to a request from legislative fiscal office, I don't have any figures. I do note on other bills we've had in the past on task forces, they have usually come in at the 50,000 or under. I don't know if this will or not, given the database issue, although that is a May. I note in the bill it's a May-created database.
There's no salaries at all.
But I don't have anything yet on this from the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Mr. Chair, we have one more meeting, two more meetings?
We have Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, and Monday.
Could we see if we get some information on this and see if it turns into a minimal? If it does, that would be handy. So I'd rather sit it here if you're willing to do that for a couple of days and see if we can track anything down through LFO.
Mr. Olson?
One note is that Legislative Fiscal has a tremendous amount that they're working on. I can't guarantee that I will have this back by April 30th. Hopefully I will, to have the fiscal, I mean. But I'm waiting on some other bills.
So. Let's do that, and let's see if you're willing, Mr. Chair. And if it turns out that we don't have information, or we have information that it's more than a minimal, then we'll get authorization to send it to Ways and Means. Otherwise, Senator Flores, is that
comfortable with
you, Representative Crimmel?
That'd be fine with me.
Representative Dom, would you be willing to withdraw your motion?
Well, I would move we table the motion.
We'll table the motion, and I.
Can you hold off on tabling?
Right.
The reason why I ask that, Mr. Chair, is because I have a couple of other things that I'd like to point out. And
briefly,
tabling is a non-debatable motion.
I withdraw the table motion.
The motion is withdrawn. I just want to look at it.
It's just two things. Number one, on page one, line 10, where it provides for one representative from DHS who provides addiction and mental health services. I really wouldn't mind seeing that too, but I'll leave that to the discretion of the committee. The other thing is that on page two, line two, line 10, or somewhere in there, what I'm wondering is that shouldn't there be a clause in there about this task force being able to recommend legislation to the legislature? And otherwise, I mean, and if the committee says no, we don't want to take either one of those things up, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I'm just wondering if that doesn't make it a little bit more useful.
I believe on page two, lines 21-22, it says may include recommendations for legislation. But if that's
I missed that.
Your comment is noted.
Okay, never mind that one. I missed that. And I even had it yellowed out.
Representative Donald.
Mr. Chair, in deference to my colleague and his legislation, I would like to move the bill, and for the exact same reason I had to be a little pensive on the last one. In this case, a bill is better than no bill. And if we wait and lose the bill because of poor timing, I felt last time we need some help for school districts on managing cyberbullying. 14 years to get information disseminated to our government agencies and to the people that can use it is too long. For that reason, in deference to my colleague, I would say let's move the bill. If there's horrendous things wrong with it, there's two places that seem to fix everything, Ways and Means and the Senate. Let's employ those wonderful people and have them go.
Looks like I'm getting thumbs up from the committee. Then I will, I'm getting nods of the head. I'll go ahead and accept. We're still under your motion. We haven't.
I'm trying to save my
pride here. Donald has moved House Bill 3267 to the floor with due pass recommendation. I think we've discussed it. I appreciate the input. And if the clerk would call the roll.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Donald.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative
Hall. Aye.
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Lynn?
Aye.
Representative
Rublin?
Aye.
Representative
Aye, as long as there's no mosquitoes in this bill.
I know we settled the mosquito thing.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, I would just note that the reason why I voted no is because of the fiscal issue and understanding what Representative Greenlee wanted to do. If it comes back, the only thing I would hate to see is that it gets to the floor and then all of a sudden there's a fiscal, so we have to send it to Ways and Means from the floor. But if that happens, it happens.
That's what we'll do.
But I don't have any other major heartburn or reasons to oppose the bill. So on the floor, if there's no issues with the fiscal, I'll support the bill.
Thank you, Representative.
I just want to, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
In the page two, for that the appropriation but there is no money involved at all. And so there's some conflict in it. And we need to appropriate certain amount of expenses, but there's absolutely no money in here. So I hope we can resolve it at the other side.
Thank you, Representative. The motion carries. Representative Greenick, I would assume you might want to carry this on the floor.
I'd love to carry it.
Thank you very much, Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've moved to suspend the rules to allow Representative Roblin and Representative Crumble, if he'd like, to vote on HB 2637.
Representative Wisnett has made a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Roblin and Representative Crummell to vote on House Bill 2637.
3627. I think that's what
it was. No, it's 2637.
Yep. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the motion carries. Representative Roblin, how would you like to vote on House Bill 2637?
Aye.
Representative Crummell, how would you like to work or vote on House Bill 2637?
It was the -2 amendments that were
adopted. That's correct.
I'll vote aye.
So noted. We close that work session. Thank you very much. Close the work session on House Bill 2637 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2584. Representative Bonici, good to see you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2584 creates a task force on, the original bill was designed to create a task force around kindergarten through grade 12 education. What you have before you is a -2 amendment that replaces the entire text of the bill and creates a 12-member task force on civics and financial education, with the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Speaker of the House, and President of the Senate, each appointing 4 members from groups representing, quote, school administrators, civics teachers, finance educators, school district boards, students, business leaders, and other groups with expertise in civics and financial education, unquote, and direct the task force to study and make recommendations on how to increase and improve civics and financial education in K-12 public schools. Directs the task force to submit a report to the Interim Committees on Education by October 2008. Directs the Department of Education to provide staff support. And sunsets the task force on the opening of the next regular biennial legislative session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative Bonamici, what do you have to say about this one?
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. Suzanne Bonamici, State Representative for House District 34 in Washington County. Thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. I started out with a bill that was a task force on civics education. I'm happy to report that I'm pleased to be sharing that task force with financial education, which is also important. I know you have heard at least one bill about civics education already, so I'm going to be very brief and talk about just briefly about the importance of civic education. I believe you all received the Oregon Civic Survey that was done by the Classroom Law Project, where they reported, after doing a survey of Oregon high school students, almost 800 Oregon high school students from around the state, that despite taking a course in U.S. government in their senior year, students' knowledge of structures and functions of government and current political issues is modest at best. One of their recommendations was to do further research to better define the effects of various promising approaches on civic education. And also one of the recommendations was to have a teacher professional development program for civic education and have that developed. So those are some of the things that I hope this task force, once approved, will be able to further. And it is, again, a very important part of what students learn is not just about the 3 branches of government, but how they can, in fact, as students and future citizens, get involved in their government. So, again, thank you very much for hearing this bill. And I believe you're going to hear from someone about the financial education part, which I also support. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
I just have one technical question.
Yes.
And in the relating clause, it said to study morals of teachers, staff, and students. And we got it whole thing and talking about the civics and financial education. So does it have any relating in it or what? Have you discussed with the legislative council on this issue?
Thank you, Representative Lim. This is actually one of my placeholder bills with the relating clause relating to education. So it's a very broad relating clause. It's the original House Bill 2584.
In the bill said it, the morals of teachers. And I want to make sure it connects. There's no problem.
No morale. See, we are
both.
We are.
I did the same thing. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for practicing.
As much as I hate to give up the task force on morale, which I received a lot of flack about.
I submit, Chair Buckley, that if students learn more about civics education, everyone's
all right.
morale.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you again.
Yeah.
Representative Roblin.
Yes.
I just want to say that I think that this bill is important. There were a number of other bills out here that had to do with developing programs for financial education, for dealing with each of these issues. And I think until we do some studies, it also develop, from my perspective, goes right along with the collaborative bill we already passed. This is the kind of thing, this information could go to that collaborative. They might decide that we need to have, you know, a collaborative based on content and in different areas, including financial and others. So this would give them the information they might need to do that. So from my perspective, this is the kind of bill that dovetails with the others to start giving us the information we need to start finding out what best practices are. And it's exactly the reason why we did the collaborative bill earlier, in my opinion. If we had that working, we may not be here today having to have this discussion because we would have already known what the research was. But this can help kickstart the other bill we already had. So I appreciate you bringing it.
Thank you, Representative Roblin.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Representative Marmucci. Mr. Sure. Olson, if you'd be so kind as to call our next panel.
Thank you. We have a panel of three, Pam Levitt, Claudine Oriani, and Corey Fraudenheimer. Matt?
Thank you, Mr. Olson. While they're getting ready, Representative Whitson, do you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm glad to see this bill here, even though I'm concerned about the morale of everyone, too. But as the committee will remember, I introduced a bill that was a little more, not going to study, we're going to implement and require, add to the graduation requirement, one-half civics and one-half financial management. But I'm glad at least we're making some effort to address these needs to the students. I will hope this great task force that we're going to create and the good people here at the table that are going to talk about that, I would hope that their recommendation would include some things we can do and then also a recommendation, do we need to add this to the graduation requirement? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt, representing the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We represent 85 state and federally chartered credit unions in Oregon. It's nice to be before you. I'm usually stuck in House and Senate Business Committee, and I don't have an opportunity to usually to be before education, so I'm very honored to be here today. I hope you don't see this as just a simple task force. This financial education is something credit unions, other financial institutions, other business entities have been really talking about for years, and many states do mandate financial education. That's not a position we've taken. We don't. We understand that our wonderful teachers in Oregon are under many, many requirements, and our issue is how do we really let our students learn more about this issue. I brought some experts along with you. I just want to say a few things. Credit unions across the nation in Oregon continue to teach our youth about financial education voluntarily. We hear over and over again, and there's a recent article that you have in your packets, that students said one of the things that we're not learning when we get out of high school is personal finance and financial education. It's one of those life skills that we're just not getting. Financial education in schools has never been more important than now. This legislature is dealing with a lot of consumer issues, the payday and title lending controversies, predatory lending, bankruptcy issues, and a lot of this comes from the need for not only our youth but all of our citizens to learn how to manage their money. The Credit Union Association of Oregon has been a leader in this issue for several years. We have introduced financial education bills not only this session but last session, and the direction we took was to ask the Department of Education to have a model financial curriculum available that the teachers can use. It wasn't a mandate, but it was a place that teachers who did want to teach this could go. And those bills did not pass last session. There was a high fiscal on them. And so we are encouraged by this concept of a task force. We think that, as Representative Roblin said earlier, that this is an opportunity for us to really study the ability for schools to teach this. recent studies have shown that our students really need this. An entering college freshman has an average debt of $1,500 on a personal credit card. I didn't get my first credit card till I was a junior in college. 4 out of 10 Americans believe they are living beyond their means, primarily because of misuse and misunderstanding of credit. Americans under 25 are filing for bankruptcy faster than any other age group. And finally, according to the Jumpstart Coalition, which you'll hear more about, personal financial literacy survey, high school seniors could only answer about 50% of questions they ask correctly. Credit unions are leaders in Oregon. We don't necessarily say we have all the answers. We do support the National Endowment for Financial Education, and you have a model curriculum that we'll talk about. We go into the schools. Many of our credit union individuals spend a lot of time on their own teaching financial education, and the two of the leaders in the state I have here today are going to talk about it. Finally, I will just say that this is an issue that's extremely important to it. Our tellers, our loan officers, our CEOs are seeing this every day, people coming in and needing financial education. One of the things that we've been testifying in the legislature is our alternative payday loan product. We offer a short-term loan product that has much better interest rates and fees than some of the payday lending operators. Every credit union in the state will tell me that they don't offer that product and just say, here you go, here's your $500 loan, we'll see you next month. They require their members to have some financial education training, and they sit down with them, and the goal is, let's figure out how you don't need this loan, not how we can roll it over month after month. So we're leaders in the classroom, we're leaders in our branches on trying to help consumers, but these two ladies sitting next to me are the two ladies that you should hear from, because they live it every day. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Buckley and honorable members of the House Education Committee. My name is Claudine Oriani, and I'm the Director of Community Education with OSU Federal. In the 4 years since we implemented our financial literacy outreach programs in the 5 counties that we are chartered to serve, I have seen a repeated theme throughout. Clearly, administrators, educators understand the value of financial literacy, but unfortunately in our world, what gets measured gets done. And I'd say that our outreach programs have only been successful in about 15% of the schools in the regions that we could be serving, because there are so many other obligations that have to be met. What I'm also seeing is in the schools where we have been invited to provide financial support, financial education support, I am basically preaching to the choir. Because these are rendered through elective courses where, quite frankly, socioeconomically, the average student that's staring at me as I'm ranting and raving about the importance of money management comes from a well-to-do family or a family that's not struggling. Very likely, these families are already modeling positive money management behavior. Of course, most human beings learn by observing more than just being spoken to. Those that need it the most, and that same classification that is most likely to fall prey to the predatory lending practices mentioned by Pam this afternoon, are the least likely to attend or elect for the courses where we meet with them face to face. And what I'm seeing is that these young people, now I know Oregon Education is doing a wonderful job in preparing them to generate income through vocational school programs, through the career-related learning education objectives. Unfortunately, they don't have a clue what to do with the money once they make it, however small or large that sum may be. And so I'm here strongly supporting House Bill 2584 so that the task force can address the resources available, the need, the actual need, and how, without crippling our school system, we can help support financial literacy on a more broad scope basis. And thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Buckley and members of the Education Committee. My name is Corey Fondiner, and I am currently the Director of Education Partnerships with MAPS Credit Union here based in Salem, Oregon. My work takes me right out into the schools every day. We have been in a program since 1994 that established a working opportunity for our students in the 24J school district to learn financial education and then apply it in a working lab within the school so that they could understand how to become not only good consumers and good management of money managers, but to also take that education to their peers in the school. We started this in 94 as a way to support the newly adopted SIM and CAM requirements that were just being rolled out. We did that because we thought with the SIM requirement, if we had our students going into the sophomore econ classes that were in effect at that time, they could give them a safe place to learn and they could be supported. We collaborated with the school system at the time. We also used this program as a CAM requirement to help them get the school to work requirements in a safe environment in the school during the school hours that they needed to have. It's been a very successful program. We started at North Salem High School in 1994. We added McKay High School in 1998 and West Salem High School in 2001. What we've seen happen is we've got students that come into the school there in this program, but they also realize their peers aren't getting this education. We have students that want to know this, but they don't have an opportunity. What our students in our class have done is written curriculum themselves to take to the out to their peer group in the school. They have also written curriculum that is appropriate for elementary school and middle school, and they partner with those schools by contacting the administrators, asking to have an opportunity to visit with them, give this education, and help them start at a young age, which we know is vital in education financial management. Our young students love this because they're learning from those big kids, and that's nothing more powerful than those a senior in high school coming and telling a third grade boy, gosh, you know, if you do this, you're going to get your Letterman sweater when you play football. This is powerful stuff. So we see that it works. We see students that are successful. We have worked in conjunction also with the FBLA, the Future Business Leaders of America, to get education within that arena out into more schools. We really see that financial literacy is not an option. It's a mandatory life skill. One of the most exciting articles I read was the one that I think Pam referenced earlier about someone saying that they wish they had this financial education when they were in school. Talked about all the life skills that they didn't have. In response to that, I read in the Oregonian a couple of weeks later a gentleman who wrote in and said, well, I support enhanced math education, enhanced science education, reading, writing. I don't really think that life skills should be taught in school. It should be taught in home. That's a good concept. Much of the bankruptcy, the payday lending, the cash stores that we see, and that extremely high credit card balances that are in the billions of dollars now aren't our little kids. These are our adults. We need to make sure that we are having a conversation that concludes with a cohesive, comprehensive program that gives education to everyone so that we can have a citizens base that goes out there. They know how to handle their money, and I think this task force is a perfect way to start out. Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you, and I'll give it back to Pam.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add, we are supporting the DASH 2 amendments.
Very good. Thank you so much. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your work. We are flat out of time, members. So what I'm going to do, and Mr. Allen, if you are available to come back on Wednesday, we'll hear from you on Wednesday. Pam, I don't know if you're available on Wednesday. We're going to carry over this House bill, House Bill 2584. We're also carrying over House Bill 2790 to Wednesday, April 25th. Thank you so much for your patience in being here. Representative, something real quick?
Really quick. Representative Wisnett wanted to mandate personal finance. I'm wondering, Pam, if we should do a recall in education, classes 74 to 2006.
Representative, real quick. Thank you, sir. I just want to acknowledge two leaders from my community. The chair of our school board is actually here, and the CEO of MAPS Credit Union. And you heard Corey talk about the partnership, and I think you might be here on a different issue even, but she happens to have walked in the room. So, and I'm going on a tour Friday of the North Salem, so when I'll have some information about how it's been going for them.
Thank you, Representative. Members, just to clarify, these will be work sessions on House Bill 2790 and House Bill 2584. Mr. Morgan will ask you for your testimony during our work session, if that's okay with you. Thank you, members, for your work and your attention today. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2584. And with nothing else, I'll go ahead and close this hearing on the House Education Committee. Thank you.